Thanks for listening to this Word in Your Ear podcast. If you'd like to get early access to all our productions ad-free, priority booking for our live events, and to take part in our weekly quiz, go to patreon.com/wordinyourear for more details.
You're listening to a podcast from The Word.
Well, look, thanks for coming. Now, there was a time when the young teenage me could be found stumbling about in suede boots and old scarves and army surplus greatcoats, proudly clutching my copies of This Was and Stand Up by Jethro Tull. I'd probably wish I had a crimson bowler hat as well. And I can only imagine my boyish excitement if I had known that one day this magnificent group would be about to embark on their 50th anniversary tour. And that day has come. Please welcome the magnificent Ian Anderson.
Thanks very much indeed. Thank you.
We shall address the tour later.
Yeah, the man at the curtain. It's okay to let the girls in now.
As one.
And there's the reason why we're here. Your 50th anniversary tour, which starts in... when does it start? In early April. So you've started rehearsing for that, Ian?
Yeah, we did a little bit of prep. The guys in the band are really very good at coming in fairly well armed with all the parts and arrangements they've got to do. Because I send it to them weeks, months before. They get MP3 files and set lists and stuff that's rather tedious. But I don't even send it. They pluck it from the ether. Pluck it from the ether. It's on Dropbox, but you can't get it. They can. So it's a shared Dropbox folder that has all the itineraries, all the flight numbers and the booking references and all the stuff a band and crew need in order to save me money on having an expensive tour manager, which I'm not going to do.
You can tell he manages his own group.
Quite rightly. We're going to talk about that in detail later on. But the 50th anniversary tour, has that been part of your plans for a while, that you were definitely going to do it?
Well, this time last year, I was definitely not going to do it. It was... not my idea of... I'm not a nostalgic person, really. Anniversaries, birthdays, even on a personal level, it doesn't work for me. So I really was determined I would just let this year slip by. And then, around the middle of the year, I thought, well, maybe we should, just maybe slip in a few dates in the UK just for old time's sake. And then, of course, that grew. And then I find myself getting rather enthused by the idea of the murky nostalgia and celebrating the idea that you are literally kind of old guys and still doing what you set out to do. You see, when I grew up, I didn't go for pop music or whatever was in the charts. It was blues and folk music and stuff. And everybody I listened to were my father's age. I mean, they're all old guys. So I grew up with the idea that my musical heroes being old men when I was listening to them as a young teenager, that's kind of the way things work. And so it didn't seem too odd after a couple of years of being in Jethro Tull that it could be a career for life, and that's the way it's turned out. We die with our boots on us, people in the world of arts and entertainments. We don't get retired.
So what was on the record player? This is a traditional Word in Your Ear question. What was on the record player when you were growing up in your house?
Did you have a record player in your house when you were growing up?
No, we had a gramophone.
Oh, of course. Yeah.
With little brass needles that put in. And then,
so a wind-up. We're talking wind-up.
No, it was the age of electricity.
Right. can you remember any records that were played on this
thing? Yeah, the stuff that I listened to when I was about 7 or 8 years old. My father allowed me very carefully to play some of his 78 RPM shellac records, which were basically big band music, mostly American, mostly big band stuff. And it had a kind of a thing that got my attention. It was a bit more interesting than Presbyterian church music and folk music that I grew up with in Scotland. And it was the syncopation. It was the fact that it had this. I couldn't put my finger on it as a child, but it was the blues scale, and it was syncopation. That's what drew me into that music. And then when I heard, at the age of 9, I think I heard Elvis Presley singing Heartbreak Hotel, and that you know, kind of got me in a slightly into the idea of American rock and roll. And growing up post-war, you see, we had access to American comics, and we even had a couple of Americans in our primary school in Edinburgh. So I got a little bit of that childhood Americana, Daisy air guns, and the weird kind of bikes that they used to ride over their children, which they still make, in the name of which I can't unfortunately remember right now. But yeah, I grew up with that kind of Americana thing, and so rock and roll and then blues and American jazz, that's what shaped my teenage years.
Well, you say you're not one for nostalgia, but we're going to have to go back, I'm afraid. That's Dunfermline, which is where you grew up, and that's probably taken round about the time you were living there, and I don't know, in the 50s.
The car there is looks like a dead ringer for the car my father had.
Right.
And I remember to this day that the registration number of that car, which I think was called a Vanguard,
right,
or something,
yes,
such, and it was parked outside our house in 54 Murrayfield Avenue in Edinburgh, which we moved to when I was 3 years old. And the registration number was AGE 284.
Right.
And that's stuck in my mind. And, of course, I'm way behind that.
What did your father do?
He took over his father's business. He started off as a surveyor in a mine in the Fifeshire area, and went down the mines with a piece, as they would call it, which was just coal stuff that you would chew on way down there, and porridge made just from water and salt and oatmeal, cold, and just in a flask, which would then, by the time it got to lunchtime, it sort of turned into a kind of cold porridgey mess, and that's what they ate. And it was, you know, it was truly working down the mine.
Yeah.
But then he took over my father's
company, was it?
Yeah, was. I think his father was involved in the steam engines that did all the mine work and hauled coal, and presumably engines that worked the lifts, you know. So it was he had a company that was making a concoction, a chemical concoction that he'd come up with, which would descale steam boilers of all kinds of steam trains, anything. And it was called the RSA, Robert Sharp Anderson, the RSA Boiler Fluid Company. I just love fluid. It just, yes, it's just, you know, the bodily fluid company. It's perfect, you know.
So what was his reaction to your early forays into? You had a group of the Blades, wasn't it? The first group you were in?
Well, that was at school, at Blackpool Grammar School, once we at 12, yeah, at 12 we left to go to live in Blackpool, which is where my parents met as young people, in the Tower Ballroom of Blackpool.
Yeah. Actually in the Tower Ballroom.
Yeah, dancing, yeah. He was from Scotland on the Scottish week, you know, when
right,
he
yeah,
came
they
down
all
there.
Used to descend on holiday.
She was from Manchester family, and they, you know, they met on the floor of the Tower Ballroom. And so it was a weird kind of belief that one day they might return to the roots of their relationship. And so, yes, I am a product of that union between Scotland and England, so you can guess which way.
Yes, you can save the time.
I felt about the referendum, which I'm not allowed to vote in because I technically was not a householder, so I couldn't take a part in the referendum vote. Even Gavin Esler, my pal, was mightily put out when Alex Salmond said, "Well, you're not getting the vote." And said, "I'm Scottish. That's where I grew up." And he said, "Nope, you need to. You can only vote in the referendum if you've got a hoose in Scotland," which, of course, Gavin, working with the BBC, did not have. So, yeah, we were all banned from voting, even though we might have felt the Scottish connection was more than just a passing one.
So how did your parents feel when you were first interested in...
Pretty much the same way as I would feel if my children had come to me and said, "We want to be in a rock band." So, you know, the answer is... get a day job, you know, and think about it. But plan A, plan B, plan C, that always seemed sensible to me. So at the time when I was at school, wondering what I might do, I did have two or three career choices in mind, and being following something in arts and entertainment seemed like a third choice for me because it was a bit too risky.
What were the others?
The first choice was to be a policeman. I tried to enrol in the Blackpool Police Force as a cadet. They turned me down because I had too many O levels. And that is actually the truth. Yes.
Well, they thought you were a troublemaker.
They thought that I was leaving school too early, and I should finish my education and get a law degree, and then come back. And they said, "I'll give you a really good job in the police force." So it was a very responsible and sensible approach. However disappointing it was to me.
So you were what, 15 or something at the time,
and you were 16.
Went along to the police station, and said, "I'd like to be a policeman."
That's right. And I also went along to the Blackpool Evening Gazette because I thought, I want to follow some real scurrilous profession. I'll be a journalist.
Yeah.
Did you turn up there and say, "I'd like to be a journalist"?
Turned up and said, I'd like to be a newspaper person, please. And they said, "Sorry, we have no vacancies." I said, "I'll make the tea." They said, "We've already got one of those." And so I didn't get a look in there.
But seriously, were you the kind of person, even quite young, when you were motivated to go and do that? You know, you go in the front door and say, I want to be...
I really didn't want to stay on. I wasn't enjoying school. And just because you happen to pass exams, if you're not having fun with it, it didn't seem... You know, it was probably a silly decision in some ways, but good decision in the others. And I was actually chucked out in the end and expelled, as indeed my wife was expelled from a convent. Technically, it wasn't expulsion. I think in both cases, it was suggested we didn't return the following day.
right.
You were let go.
So we talked a little bit about the music that excited you, growing up. Big band music was initially a kind of a big thing with you, was it?
Well, it wasn't a big thing, but it was an awakening of a kind of music that had that... you know, when you can't, you've got a little bit of the hairs go up in the back of your neck, and you know something happening, but you can't put a name to it because I didn't have any musical education. But it was syncopation, the blues scale, something a bit naughty about it. But it was also quite sophisticated, and of course it did contain improv solos. Saxophone players just suddenly started to fly and play solos, which always seemed incredibly exciting. And incredibly, like a black magic, a black art. You know, I didn't know how you would go about doing that. It seemed impossible that you could figure that out and the brain could work fast enough. But it intrigued me. So that was what I wanted to do.
And it was a time when a lot of, you know, white British groups were playing black American blues, weren't they? I mean, there were quite a lot of...
Well, it was the same time as I was getting interested. Yeah. I think the catalyst was actually a series of tours that came over from the US to Europe, not just to the UK. And they featured all the legendary blues
performers. Oh, yeah,
Johnny
Hooker, that's right, yeah.
Exactly, all that stuff.
Stones involved with it.
And I saw that tour at the Manchester Free Trade Hall.
Oh, right.
And I'm pretty sure the same tour, when it played in other places, that you would have found Jeff Beck and Ritchie Blackmore and Jimmy Page and Eric Clapton. They all would have been at these gigs, because the buzz was...
Yeah.
These were the people that we were getting excited about. It was definitely a subculture, definitely just the word on the street. And if you could club together and buy a blues album from some little record store that imported American music, this was heady stuff. It wasn't... this was long before the time when you could go to iTunes or Spotify. Now, anything you want in the world that's ever been recorded is just a couple of finger... jabs away.
Do you think there's a chance?
Trust me on that one. You're too old. You probably don't have computer skills.
Do you think it's a shame that nowadays all music is so available, whereas when you grew up, you had to hunt it out.
Yeah, you had to hunt it down. It was hunting too, and that was part of the thrill. But on balance, I think I prefer the accessibility. So, you know, I'm an internet and computer guy, and have been since the BBC Acorn computer. Anybody remember that one?
Yeah.
Or the ZX 81.
Yeah.
Gosh.
Yeah, we pitched in with all of that stuff back then. And so computers that were becoming, as soon as they were word processors even, then they were in the office, and it just became something you really had to learn to use. And so we learned all that stuff, and our children, who were teeny, they were, you know, jabbing away at keyboards and things. No idea what they were doing, but whereas adults seem to be afraid of pressing the wrong button and doing something terrible, whereas children just find their way through it all, and that's the world we live in. So it is accessible, and that's probably a good thing, because it's so difficult to find serious porn when I was a kid. There was something called H&E, Health and Efficiency.
Oh, yes.
Okay, anybody remembers
Never
that
heard,
one?
Yeah.
It's got a dirty secret. I think you should share it with us
no
all
idea.
Now.
Topless people playing tennis.
It used to be available in the one shop in town that also sold kind of rubber goods and things like that.
It was
a very curious kind of subset of the retail market.
Hmm.
Don't look at me like that.
Anyway, we've got a picture, I think, of the John Evans Band. This is them in 1960. What would it be?
Yeah, and an interesting thing is it does have the S. We've been going through all of this for the tour program, back and forth over the last few weeks, because John Evans was his name, and John Spencer Evans, and his mother was Mrs. Evans with an S. But we dropped the S. I think maybe it was his idea, maybe it was Geoffrey Hammond's idea, that we John Evan sounded a little bit more kind of sexy.
I love the way you tinkered with names. Didn't you change Geoffrey Hammond's name to Geoffrey Hammond Hammond at one point?
Well, his
it didn't sound posh enough.
Well, the truth was that his father, his surname was Hammond, and he married a lady who was also called Hammond.
That's right, yeah. Oh, really?
So we decided to hyphenate them. Again,
that's
I'm not sure.
So
it may have been Jeffrey's idea, maybe mine.
No disrespect to the great John Evan, who's on the right in that picture playing the keyboard, but why was it called the John Evans Band and not you on the left there, were the leader of the group and the harmonica player and the singer?
Because his mum paid for the van.
Oh, okay. As simple as that, was it?
It was as simple as that. Yeah. And then later on, she paid when he played the drums, you see, originally when it was the Blades at Blackpool Grammar, and then switched to playing Hammond organ because his mother was a piano teacher. And he'd done up to grade eight, you see, at school. So it was natural for him to switch. We couldn't afford a Hammond to begin with. It was a Farfisa, this dreadful plasticky thing that was. It was either that or a Vox Continental, but everybody used those. So we thought we'll do the Farfisa, but it was a step too far in plasticky horrible terms. So whilst that is the Farfisa.
What other names did you go through? Can you remember any other names?
Well, it was the John Evan. The first thing was the John Evan without the S. Blues, not the John Evan Blues Band,
just
the John Evan Blues.
So what year are we talking about here? 1966?
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah. And then 67, it was the John Evans band on this piece of photographic promo stuff. But that's a misprint. It was, in fact, called the John Evan Band. It was also called at one point the John Evan Smash. And then we had appeared a couple of times at the Marquee Club trying to, you know, get a foot in the door unsuccessfully. We went back as Navy Blue, which is another of the names, and then I remember one turning up at some pub somewhere, you know, not unlike this little room in the back of a pub, and on the blackboard in the pub, you know, probably said meat pies, you know, 2 and 6 pence or whatever, and tonight Ian Henderson's Bag of Blues. So we arrived to unload our van and thought, must be us. So you turn
close
me,
enough.
Close enough. So if you're going to get paid a tenner, you'd show up and do it. But then the lucky time when our agent gave us the name Jethro Tull, having studied history at school, and since I didn't know he'd named us after an 18th century agriculturalist who invented the seed drill. And it was only a couple of weeks later when I learned the awful truth that it was too late, because the first appearance was on the 2nd of February 1968 at the Marquee Club, the first time we were billed as Jethro Tull at the Marquee. So that was the watershed, because John G, the manager at that point, decided, I'll pretend that I don't know you've tried here 2 or 3 times, I'll give you every second Thursday. So we were now a resident band at the Marquee Club, which was not just
a
foot in the door. That was a passport to fame and fortune.
This is probably you with Jethro Tull in 1968. So that's, can I just, you know, that's quite a switch, isn't it?
This is two years. The guy on the left is pretending to be Patrick McGoohan from Danger Man, because I was infatuated by that kind of transatlantic cool accent.
Yeah.
And I love the balloons. And so my whole persona was built around this sort of rather smooth kind of transatlantic.
It's kind of fast
twit.
Show.
Yeah. Twit.
You know.
Yeah. But with this embryonic moustache and beard, which was suitably embellished with a little bit of charcoal from,
right.
liberated from the from Blackpool Art College.
But seriously, 2 years later, you're yeah. that. How does that happen?
Yeah, well, it's same wispy beard. It's just hair grew out a little bit. And in fact, I'm wearing Glenn Cornick's jacket because I actually couldn't afford a jacket of my own. And later on, in fact, what was really famous was that I wore the old overcoat my father gave me. And that was my real uniform that got people's attention was the big old...
Let's talk about great coats. I'm really glad you've brought up the subject mm-hmm. because I wanted to... Seriously, great coats
were a big thing. I have a feeling it's going to be the next photograph.
Great coats were a big thing, weren't they? 1968? Why yeah. were they such a big thing?
I don't know.
Army great coats.
Everybody
had
surplus,
one.
Salvation
in,
Army.
In my father's case, it was a big, worsted, sort of dark grey gentleman's coat. It wasn't an ex-army.
Oh, yours was proper.
It was the real deal, yeah.
Okay. And we could only afford cheap ones.
Yeah, yeah. No, he threw this to me along with a blazer as I was leaving home. And he would no have a you know good luck son or hope everything works out or of course you know the minute you want to come back just phone us and we'll send the money for a train ticket, nothing like that. But just his words were he tossed this at me,
take this blazer and go.
He just said it's going to be a cold winter.
Oh God, that's great. None more Scottish.
Yeah. And it was bloody freezing in the winter of 1967 was really nasty.
Right. So there you are on the you know on the marquee list of acts who are playing in November 1968. What was it like playing the marquee in those days?
It was a little bit scary because you know I spent the 2 years before I'd been working in a in Lewis's department store in Blackpool, earning a little bit of money in the summer and was in charge of the magazine stall. It sold all kinds of magazines except not the one we talked about earlier. And but it was you know Melody Maker, New Musical Express, Record Mirror, Sounds. All these things were the newspapers that I would read voraciously during my lunch break. I would smuggle a Melody Maker up to the staff canteen and pore over all these names of people playing it, particularly in London. Which was obviously the big prize if you could make it to London try and if we knew streets were not paved with gold, but I did know that a man called Roy Harper, who came from the same area and been at I think St Edward's Grammar School in somewhere not just outside Blackpool, and he had left a couple of years before to seek fame and fortune as a folk singer, and the word was he hadn't come back. So either he was a success or he was dead.
Yeah.
And Roy is even to this day very much alive and is legendary. So he was the guy. He got away before I did, and in a way I was following in his footsteps. I was conscious of the fact that it was possible to leave Blackpool and get a gig, and because other Blackpool bands at the time, you know, they never made it in London.
No,
and. They were bands who were playing five nights a week and doing really pretty well. And the most famous band around at the time was Reverend Black and his Rocking Vickers.
Yeah.
And my Fender Strat that I had when I was playing guitar in the Blades, actually in the John Evan band before I quit playing guitar, was a beaten-up old white Fender Strat that had previously belonged to the rhythm guitarist of Reverend Black and the Rocking Vickers. And his name was Lemmy.
Yeah, of course.
Oh, right, yeah.
Yeah.
You were saying you were playing the guitar, but in that picture there, you'd probably only been playing the flute for a short period of time. So why did you choose the flute? Because it was a very definite decision, wasn't it, to try and find something original?
Well, reading the Melody Maker, it couldn't escape you. There were all these gunslinger guitar players down in London all doing incredibly well. And you know, to be playing not second but third fiddle to Eric Clapton or Jimmy Page or any of the guys that we heard about just didn't seem like it was a... You know, it just to be an also-ran. I knew I wasn't going to be that good as a guitar player. And so I decided to quit playing guitar and part exchange my white Fender Strat for a £30 flute, a Selmer Gold Seal, the cheapest, flimsy, awful student flute, and a Unidyne 3 Shure microphone. which is in some ways, this is a Shure 58, and then its earlier brother was the Shure 57, and the Unidyne 3 was the precursor of the Shure 57. Fascinating stuff, isn't it?
Yeah. Make a note of this. We've all learned something.
But it was just to stand out. It was to do something different.
Yeah, I mean, if you're sporting a flute, you can stand out, and it was the compactness of it and the machinery. I loved the fact it was so, you know, impeccably kind of little and brilliantly engineered. But I couldn't play it, and I got it in August of '67. Couldn't get a noise out of the damn thing, and I put it away until December, by which time I was down in Luton trying to make a go of things. And somebody said, it's a bit like blowing across the top of a bottle. Mm-hmm. You know, I can't do it with a plastic one.
No,
you know, you can do that thing where you... So suddenly I got a note, and then I got another one. But they weren't very good notes, and I found if I sang the note while I played it, then it gave it... It reinforced it, made it, you know, much more aggressive. So I had about maybe 5 notes that I could play on the flute in December, which is enough to play Smoke on the Water. Or Aqualung, or half of the music that was ever written and recorded as the blues. You know, it's essentially the blues scale. So I could do that. And by January and February, this is probably February, I was playing it, you know, at all the gigs. Not in every song, but, you know, maybe half the music. I played harmonica as well, you see.
So it's fair to say you were never short of confidence on stage.
Absolutely, you know, completely opposite. There's a fact that when you're not confident, when you really have... First of all, you know you're a charlatan because you can't really play the flute. You're just sort of making it up as you go along. And also the fact that Mick Abrahams, who was the guitar player, was a big confident sort of, on the outside anyway, confident, great singer, great guitar player, you know, life and soul kind of guy. And, you know, I had to play catch-up all the time with Mick because he came out of the box as a fully established, able musician. And confident about getting up in front of an audience, and so I had to learn pretty quickly at the Marquee Club. But it was a studied eccentricity that got me noticed because I used to arrive wearing my dad's big old overcoat, carrying a pink paper carrier bag from Woolworths.
Yes,
definitely was from Woolworths, in which there was a hot water bottle, an alarm clock, my flute, some harmonicas, and. And several packs of Dr. White's sanitary towels.
Why? Why?
Question mark over all.
Yes.
It's such a good non sequitur, that, isn't it? Well, actually, the alarm clock went off during the drum solo in order to remind everybody that drum solos could be pretty interminable. And the hot water bottle was there because I was so bloody cold most of the time. I used to clutch the hot water bottle, and I would then, of course, pretend to drink, you know, what people assume must be neat brandy from my rubbishy hot water bottle. And then the sanitary towels, which is the bit I have a feeling you're waiting to know about, were usually acquired in the ladies' loo at the Marquee Club, where there was a machine on the wall that dispensed, you know, for a few pence, a pack about the size of a hard pack of cigarettes with a sanitary towel in it. And I would buy as many of those as I could afford. And during the show, I would light up a cigarette and I'd give one to Mick, so you've got the attention of the audience. And I would light my cigarette and say, "I'm sorry, did anybody smoke?" And of course, several people would go, "Yeah." So I would take one cigarette and throw it out, and somebody grab it, you know, gleefully. And I'd rummage in the carrier bag and bring out what looked like a pack of Embassy, but in fact was another square pack, and I would toss 3 or 4 of these out into the audience, and it was like feeding frenzy at the zoo in the penguin enclosure. I mean, it was brilliant, and they pounced on these things and rustled them open, thinking a pack of 20 Bensons in there or something, and only to find, and this is the inevitability of it all, is the glorious bit that you knew that the air would be filled with returning sanitary towels when they realised what was in there, hurling them back at me, which is just great. I mean, it was theatre.
Low-cost theatre.
But you found these things absolutely. Out by not by being confident and whatever. It was just like any port in a storm.
Anything on one leg,
you could
presumably.
Do to get some kind of rapport with an audience.
Well, so presumably it was this kind of thing that brought you to the attention of Terry Ellis and Chris Wright, who were your kind of early agents, managers, people behind Chrysalis Records.
This is looking worrying, like that you have access to the yet unprinted tour program, because most of the pictures you're showing are ones.
It's all on the internet.
Well, I know that one is. Yeah. I found it there too. Yeah, that's Terry Ellis, bottom left, and Chris Wright, probably circa 1969, 70.
They managed you in the early days, didn't they? And were you booking agent? And Terry produced all the records, obviously.
Chris worked up. They were both social secretaries at their respective universities. Yeah. And we met Chris because he got us a gig somewhere in the Manchester area. And you know, I didn't think he particularly liked us, but thought we were okay. And when Terry and Chris got together to form the Ellis Wright Agency in London, Chris was our point man, the person we could go to say, can you get us any gigs in London? And that's why we moved down to Luton, ostensibly as the John Evan Band, and when the rest of them, after a couple of weeks of starvation, went back to Blackpool, leaving Glenn Cornick and me down there to get together with Clive Bunker and Mick, who'd already kind of joined as a guitar player. Yeah. That's when the seven-piece John Evan Band turned out to only be consisting of four, and none of us were called John Evan.
Right.
But it took a magical two or three weeks before this fed its way back to Chris Wright, who got very upset that we were masquerading as the band that he'd booked us out as. And in fact, we were Jethro Tull. But we were getting good, or actually not, we were the... What were they called at the time? We were probably Navy Blue by then. But whatever it was, we were getting asked to go back and play in the pubs. And so he forgave us. And Terry managed 10 years after, who you possibly remember from that period of time. Yeah. And that's Chris. And then Terry was managing a Scottish band called Clouds, who were quite good songwriters, but were never really going to make it. And
what was their biggest influence on you? What things did they change in Jethro Tull? Anything about the look and the sound?
Well, Chris tried to change the early Jethro Tull by persuading me that I should not be singing or playing the flute, that wasn't quite the proper thing to do in a blues band. And why don't you stand at the back and play rhythm piano, he said, whilst Mick, does the singing and is the front man. And, I probably humoured him and said, yeah, great idea, I'll save up and, buy a piano or something, but carried on regardless. What seems like it might have been months or even years was days in the episodic nature of how things developed. So by the end of the week, we were probably getting noticed, and I was being, spotted as the unlikely flute player in a blues band, which gave us a point of difference from purely marketing standpoint. We had something that Fleetwood Mac and Savoy Brown and Chicken Shack didn't have. We had a dodgy flute player who stood on one leg.
Absolutely.
Everybody noticed.
And is that one of the reasons why you were on the Rolling Stones Rock and Roll Circus?
I think Charlie Watson and Bill Wyman had somehow, maybe they'd stopped in at the Marquee Club or something, but they seemed to know who we were. And and they'd persuaded Mick and the producer, Lindsay Hogg.
Michael Lindsay Hogg. Yeah, he was making a television
to have us on as the token rookie band, because the other folks on this were some of them very well. The Who were on it, and Eric Clapton was on it.
Dirty Mac. Was it John Lennon and Keith Richards?
Yeah, sort of a
kind Mitch
of
Mitchell and somebody else.
Band, and they did. And John Lennon. Your Blues. Yeah. I remember them doing that, and it was really rather good.
But why didn't it come out? Because that was recorded in 1968. It didn't come out for what, 30 years? Was it 40 years?
Brian Jones wasn't in great shape at that point, and he died shortly afterwards. I think out of a sense of two things, really, out of the fact that Brian hardly played. I mean, he was just kind of out of it, and being rather ostracised by the other guys. So I think they felt a bit of guilt about it, and it wasn't a suitable memento of Brian Jones's final performance. Also, the Stones were great at rehearsal. I mean, they were brilliant. Mick Jagger whipped them on. I mean, he really, really was full of energy and enthusiasm, and he was really good. But he overcooked it in rehearsal, and by the time it came to the actual performance that was recorded, filmed, he'd kind of burnt out his voice, and it wasn't as good. The Who, on the other hand, were playing a waiting game and sort of shambled through rehearsal, falling over things. But when it came to the show, they were a powerhouse, and well rehearsed. Yeah. The Stones hadn't played for months. Yeah. It was a new album called Beggar's Banquet, which was a very good record, but they just released that. So this, of course, is post Mick Abrahams now. He'd just left a couple of weeks before, and so we called a friend.
Tony Iommi.
And that's Tony Iommi, who stepped in. Possibly can't see there, but his guitar is not plugged in. So because we didn't have a guitarist and we hadn't got time to prepare, then I think they mimed. Glenn pretended to play harmonica, but I think I'm pretty sure I was singing and playing live, but to a backing track.
Do you ever feel, looking back, and this next picture is a kind of classic reminder of this, that you met everybody? That kind of everybody was in the same world, you know. They all met each other in the Blue Boar or wherever at the speakeasy.
Yeah, well, to some extent that was the case, that you did. And sometimes, you know, people were very matey with each other. And you know, I wasn't very good at that. I wasn't, you know, I didn't drink alcohol. I wasn't really a friendly sort of gregarious type. So I tended to see other people. And sometimes, you know, there were people that you would give a nod to, if it was the Blue Boar Cafe, or in Wardour Street, the club was called the Chasse, which was just up the road from the Marquee Club. People would always congregate in there, and I think I once went there and met Roger Chapman and noticed, worryingly, that he had the word hate tattooed on the knuckles of one hand, because he was a pretty scary guy, Roger Chapman. But I was a big fan of Family, even before the Marquee Club days. They were from up north as well.
Okay. So we're looking at the famous cover of You Can All Join In, which was one of the early budget sampler albums on the Island label. Mm. And there's everybody gathered, Steve Winwood, yourself.
And as you can imagine, in this kind of group shot, there are managers and people saying, make sure you're standing at the front so you can see you. So Terry Ellis, who'd obviously said to Clouds, Billy Ritchie and the drummer chap over here, make sure you're at the front. And that's not the drummer, that's the drummer. Well, that's another Clouds guy. Make sure you're standing at the front. Whereas, of course, I said to everybody else, make sure you're standing at the back. So this is...
When was it taken at 6 a.m. or something? Some strange story. Was it?
it was a weird thing. But of course, there are actually some fairly famous people here.
Oh yeah,
Steve Winwood's there.
Sandy Denny, perhaps.
Chris Paul Rogers. Sandy Wood. Denny.
Yeah, Ian Matthews. From Free.
In fact, there's another Ian Anderson.
Ian A. Anderson. Who whinged and moaned because he believes to this day probably that he was. His contract was torn up by Chris Blackwell at Island Records because...
They'd already signed it.
Because I had said that there can't be another Ian Anderson on the Island Records label, which is complete and utter, you know, rubbish. I never said such a thing at all. I didn't even know who he was. And he was a kind of a folk singer and acoustic kind of guy. And but he got really bent out of shape because he believed that I was behind his... the end of his record contract.
So
dwindling or non-existent sales had nothing to do with it. Now, I remember once getting a royalty check, which you do, from time to time, every 6 months, yes, and it was to Ian Anderson, and it was for like 2 and 6 pence. And then I realised it was actually the other bloke. And so I'm doing the right thing. I made sure this went straight back to, you know, whatever, and to be given terms. The guy's probably... You know, hadn't 2 pennies to rub together. He'd probably be living off Cornish pasties. 2 and 6 would be a week's supply. He'd be very grateful that I returned his royalty. And this is sometime in the late '70s, okay. And I then thought, wonder if he's been getting any of my royalty checks.
Yes, yeah.
As he drove by, waving out of the way in his Porsche. Yeah.
So this is Stand Up, which was, you know, it's impossible to overemphasise what a fantastically hip record it was at the time. It was amazing.
Well, it was actually a pretty good record because it was musically it drew upon lots of other influences that I'd had, you know, in my early years, and suddenly it wasn't just blues anymore. It was bits of classical stuff and what might be called world music today. Yeah. Other different influences, and yeah, it was a you know, I was quite proud of that album. Especially because I was learning about working in the studio as well, you know, from a production point of view. It was, every day was really exciting. You found new tricks, new ideas. Working with creative people like the brother of Glyn Johns, who produced the Rolling Stones. His brother was Andy Johns, and he was a tape op. And on this, I gave him the job to actually be the engineer. It was his first gig. You know, it was great working with him. He was full of confidence, but, you know, made loads of mistakes and things, but he was very confident.
Tell us about the cover. You know, what happens? Did you just say, I want it to be pop-up figures?
This is entirely Terry Ellis. I did the first album cover. That was my idea, was to do the thing of us dressed up as old men, surrounded weirdly by a bunch of dogs. And the album would be called This Was Jethro Tull, because I knew that whatever came next, it wouldn't be that kind of a thing. I wanted to move on from the sort of blues thing that I didn't really feel was credible for a middle-class white boy to be playing the blues. So I knew whatever was next, it wouldn't be like This Was. So hence This Was. And the weirder thing, too, was that they actually let me get away with the fact that I didn't have the name of the band or the album on the front cover. It was just a photograph. And they said, you can't do that. You've got to have the name of the band, and it's got to be on the front cover, otherwise in a record shop and people don't know what it is. I said, exactly. They'll go, what's this? And then they'll pick it up and turn it over, and then they see it on the back. And so it was, the enigmatic back cover was also quite fun too. But this time it was Terry's time to come up with.
But this worked as well,
yeah,
didn't
yeah.
it?
Yeah, and it was a woodcut.
Everybody talked
he
about
found
it.
An artist called James Grashow, who worked almost exclusively in woodcuts, which is, you know, you kind of learn to do that when you're a little kid at school, or, you know, in lino, cutting lino and making prints and doing it. And he did it with wood, you know, the wooden chisel. And it's a punchy good bit of imagery, very post-hippie kind of silly, but it's a good cover. But the pop-up thing was Terry's idea.
And probably changes hands for a fortune now, doesn't it?
Well, it has been reproduced, weirdly, and expensively in more recent times in its original pop-up form. But it was, again, think record companies didn't like this stuff. You know, they didn't like not having a name on the front cover. No. And they also didn't like things that popped up and gatefold covers. They were so much more expensive, to which they wanted to apply packaging deductions, which was the bane of our lives back
then. Do you have a copy of this?
I think I do, yeah.
Your original copy of this?
Well, that I wouldn't know. I don't have a... Well, actually, I probably do have a record player somewhere, but it's not plugged in.
Really?
It's a bit like... Yeah, it's a bit like... It's a bit like, who was it? Bill Clinton, was it, you know, claiming that he didn't inhale or something? I have had record players, but I was never a big fan of vinyl. As a record producer and making music, you're so aware of the limitations of this medium that's so scratchy and the compromises you make and even sequencing the album to avoid the big dramatic song being at the end with the inner grooves having to work that much harder and inner groove distortion being a reality, phase issues, having to cut the level down lower as you went into the middle of the album. You know, it's all of these things were horrible compromises to have to make, and only really when the CD came along were we freed from some of those realities of cutting and pressing the old vinyl records.
Except this has hung on as a medium longer than CD, hasn't it?
It has, and the weird thing is, even using the same old Neumann cutting lathes that are 50, 60 years old, which is what people like EMI and others have, all those that still are usable have been purchased, pirated for spares, and are in the few places that still... Mm. Cut vinyl.
I've got to ask one quick
But the people doing it are much better at the job than they were back then, because they're such, these days they're so enthusiastic. They've learned about it. Everything is, you know, is spotless and clean, and amazingly they turn out much better vinyl cuts now. and I know because I still do it, than we did back in the 70s when George Porky Peckham, famous cutting engineer in the UK, who did Porky Prime Cuts and Led Zeppelin, everybody went to him, and George would be there, you know, with a fag on, you know, ash going all over the cutting lathe, and a place was blue with cigarette smoke, and so you wonder why your Price album is going. Little bits of ash and
very quickly, just the track we used to know on Stand Up has exactly the same chord sequence as Hotel California by the Eagles,
People continually point out.
I know. Why did you why do you never seem to complain about that? Or
well, because it'd be a bit churlish to whinge about somebody who'd written a much, much better song than my song. And if the Eagles actually toured with Jethro Tull when just after Thick as a Brick came out in America, and the Eagles were kind of unknown. They'd just got their first single, Take It Easy, had just been released. And so they were on tour with us, and I think we may well have been playing We Used to Know, might have been in the first part of the set back then, I don't know. But whatever it was, it's a chord sequence. The melody is different. The time signature is different. It has a certain... Yeah, okay. People have noticed it, but hell, you know, if I'd written Hotel California, I wouldn't want to share the royalties with anybody. No, it's that theirs is an original work. Yeah. It's a great song. Anybody who'd been proud to have written that is a piece of really good pop, easygoing American rock. Great song, much better than my song.
So you got added to the Isle of Wight bill quite late on, and you were just underneath Jimi Hendrix and above Joan Baez and Leonard Cohen.
Yeah,
what can you remember about all that?
Well, I mean, I remember being the we had to fly in a Islander little wobbly little aeroplane that flew into the Isle of Wight, and it was we knew it was a big event. It was 600,000 people there. And we showed up to do our sound check, which we insisted on doing in the morning. And of course, everybody's asleep in their tents at the from the night before. And I apologised to them, sorry for waking you up, guys. And the organisers were trying to get people out, trying to clear them out. And I said, no, you can't do that. They're in their tents. They're trying to get some kip, So I said, don't worry about it. Sorry, we have to do a sound check. Apologise about the noise, but no, don't leave. It's okay to stay here. And went through all of that, and then we did our show. It was a bit of a race against time because Hendrix, who we'd worked with before, and he was very instrumental in getting us noticed in Europe with promoters. He was a very helpful, nice guy. But at this point, he was not a happy bunny with a new band and didn't want to play Hey Joe and Purple Haze, but knew he had to. And so he didn't want to go on last, understandably, because the whole thing was going pear-shaped. I mean, they were rioting outside. It was getting really nasty. And people weren't getting paid any money. We knew we wouldn't be paid, but, going to go on anyway. What are you going to do? Get on the Islander and head back to Northolt or wherever. No, we thought we're here now. We might as well play. We know we're not going to get paid. Tiny Tim had taken the money anyway in a briefcase. So there was the last bit of money that was, he'd said, I'm not going on unless I get paid. What is one of those? And anyway, so we did the thing, and Hendrix desperately didn't want to close the show, and his crew were trying to set their gear up. And we were trying to set our gear up, and it was whoever got plugged in first was going to go on, and it was us. We did actually just Tim Hendrix was well miffed, went back to his dressing room, and we did our whatever it was our show, and then I watched the first couple of songs of Jimi Hendrix, and I knew it wasn't going to be great. It wasn't bad. He wasn't in a great mood. And sadly, he didn't live much longer than that. And it was always in my mind, this was another of those sort of sad occasions where the chance you might have had to go and give him a sort of... You didn't do man hugs back then.
No.
But if you did, it was that kind of a thing. Yeah. It was like, oh, Jimmy, cheer up. It'll be good. Go for it. Can't wait to hear Purple Haze, Jimmy. You were wanting to push him on and make him feel good, but he just had not a great night.
What did they make of you in America?
Well, we're a little weird. I said, like Zeppelin, we didn't really care whether they liked us or not, so they did. Whereas poor old Cliff, who was just desperate to be loved in America, they didn't. And to this day, of course, he carries this terrible burden.
So you think that's the secret of making it in America?
Don't care too much about it. The Americans spot phonies, and if you try too hard, they won't go for it. And Roxy Music, when they first came out, I thought, this is great. And they came and did two shows at Madison Square Gardens as the opening act, at my invitation. And it was awful. The audience hated them because they were all dressed up in sort of silly clothes and preening and trying to look very whatever they were at the time, that period of time where it was all the glam rock and silly. And the Americans just looked at them and just started booing. They just didn't like them. And it was very sad because if you've invited an act to come and work with you and they don't do well, then it's embarrassing.
You feel kind of guilty.
You do.
I'm just going to whiz through this stuff because we've got to finish it on time so you can get back.
I should explain that I'm an early morning guy and I do my promo phoners with various people in different places, usually pretty early in the morning. And tomorrow I've got an early start. And I'm on the last train back to the West Country tonight. And if I miss that, it's the bus. It's a long way, and so I got to leave on time.
I've stolen this next visual today from Classic Rock magazine, who I think ran a piece about the Jethro Tull albums ranked from worst to best, and I don't know what conclusions they came to, but I just wanted you to tell us what you think are the best and the worst.
We usually agree on this, you know, audiences, fans, and I. I'm not so different. You know, the ones that people don't really think are very good, I'm inclined to agree with you. It's, you know, we're on the same page, as they say. It's not too difficult.
Which ones are those?
Well, you know, the popular one to have disliked, unless you're a total nerd, zonked out fan, Passion Play. That was just not successful. Right. But now, of course, there are people who, for them, it's the best Jethro Tull record ever. I mean, Stephen Wilson, for example, when it came to him remixing a Passion Play, I said, Stephen, look, we just missed this one out. Yeah. Oh, no, it's one of my favourites. I said, well, I'll tell you can do it, but leave out the saxophone. So he humoured me by saying, well, I'll keep it really low in the mix. But, of course, he didn't. And so, yeah, some people just love that stuff. Iron Maiden. Steve Harris is a huge fan of a Passion Play. And it's endearing to hear that. There are people who were moved by that kind of music, but it's too dense, it's too complicated, it's a mess.
So, but broadly, you kind of...
What are the ones you like, then?
You agree with the public.
Yeah, it's a mess, but two bits of a Passion Play will be on the next tour, just to show you the best and the worst of Jethro Tull.
So you're putting together your set for the 50th anniversary, and it's going to have all your favourites.
Well, it's going to have some of my favourites and some of the things that are in there because I've not played them for a long time, and in a couple of cases, I've never played them live on stage. And then it's things like the Passion Play bit, but on the face of it, I've been like, oh, God, I have to do this. But the trouble is, once you start getting into it and you start playing it, and the guys in the band are, you know, I mean, I had to get Stephen Wilson, he's packing his suitcase to go on a world tour a couple of weeks ago. And John O'Hara, the keyboard player, said, I can't figure out this organ bit and piano bit going together here in this part of a Passion Play. And would Stephen Wilson be able to help us? I said, well, I'll send him an email, but he's leaving in the morning. And Stephen replied immediately to the email, having gone to one of his big hard drives and pulled off the keyboards for this particular part of a Passion Play and sent it to John, who then was able to, you know, work it out and figure out what was going on. But once you get into it again, you know, you start to think very much in the way that you did when you wrote the music and performed it. You put yourself back into character, your earlier self. And that's what I try to do. I try to get back into my own head, back into that frame of reference. It's a bit like being a character actor. You know, you're having to get in there and find that person again, and be that person that you were. It's not so difficult to be enthusiastic about even the rubbishy stuff.
Right, so that's Jethro Tull. Let's just talk a little bit about you and your life outside Jethro Tull. And then, you know, one of the things people always say, you know, it's one of the things that in pub conversations people say, yeah. Ian Anson, trout farmer, you know, or salmon farmer or whatever.
That's a salmon, yeah.
There it's, you go. Yeah.
But that was an incredibly
big
successful
part of
business,
your life, this, you know, the enterprises well, outside
yeah, for,
music.
For 20 years, it was. And it was, it's, you know, I didn't get to be a policeman, didn't get yeah. to be a journalist. You know, if all you leave behind you is, oh, I just did this one thing, I played the flute and stood on one leg, you know, big deal. And, you know, St. Peter says, oh, all right, well, come on in anyway. I don't suppose you did any salmon farming, did you? Oh, I did that as well, yeah.
Oh, come on, get you a great
We're looking for one.
Yeah. Yeah. So, yes, that was 20 years of being an aquaculturalist and also a fish processor. And unlike everybody else, I had the audacity to do everything from... the brood pens were in here where the mature fish were kept for eggs and we would produce the eggs. We would then put them to our freshwater sites where they grew on as smolts and then transfer them to the sea, grow them on for a couple of years, send them to our one of our three different processing plants in, around the Inverness area. And then they would be in Sainsbury's and in lots of interesting places that we got into. Not necessarily because people knew it was anything to do with me, no. Because I didn't want to get too sort of, you know, too involved with it from a publicity point of view. I don't want to use me as a marketing tool to sell fish. So it was, you know, I kept out of the way most of the time.
So why did you stop?
Environmental issues to do, not with the ones that most people consider about, but it's actually mainly to do with the feed stuff, that we're plundering the oceans for prey species that salmon eat in the wild because they don't like eating rubbish. They only eat what they like to eat. As wild fish, and so we're plundering the oceans for capelin and other species, oily fish species, in order to produce highly concentrated feed pellets, which are easier to handle and get a much better food conversion ratio. And
we're all taking notes here.
And it just began to become something that the excitement, the pioneering days of aquaculture, from a standing start, it was. Working in a marine environment, it was scary, it was dangerous. I mean, big storms and terrible things happening. But after a while, I just felt it was getting too industrialised. And you know, when you're a major supplier to a company like Sainsbury's, you have to just, you can't
book them back.
No, well, it's a huge cost.
Yeah, 400 don't feel like it today.
Yeah.
You can't do that.
And of course, they will place impossible demands on you, especially at Christmas, where it's the big selling season. So it was stressful. You know, I'd be on tour somewhere else, and then, you know, getting some scary news, what was happening back home, you know, with producing fish, or problems we had, you know, sometimes with storms and inevitably disease, although we were very good at keeping. I know, I work with Friends of the Earth and Greenpeace. I try to establish a rapport to try and explain to people what we were doing. And some of the bogeyman stories were just whipped up, just rubbish. But there were bad things about salmon farming and most forms of conventional agriculture and food production that made me uncomfortable, that I couldn't really ultimately stand up and defend everything about it. So I decided it was time to move on.
But you've taken on big enterprises and you've also run the band... pretty much since 1974.
Yeah, but it's not rocket science, is it?
Well, except that we were talking about it beforehand, and I could only think of Dave Clark of the Dave Clark Five.
Great drummer.
I read a wonderful interview with you.
He managed his own group.
He said on a tour bus you like to relax by reading spreadsheets of the band's accountancy. You know,
actually, it's not true. I have been on a tour bus, but only when it's... you know, a short journey where we're on the way back to an airport or something after the end of a tour. But I'm not a bus guy. I can't sleep on a bus. I have to sleep in a bed. And I'm preferably half an hour after I've come off the stage, I'm asleep. I can't do this bus thing.
It's half an hour? Really?
It's too rock and roll for me.
Half an hour from stage to bed?
It's probably an hour to get packed up, cleaned up, back to the hotel, but boom.
So you're not one of those people who comes off stage fizzing with adrenaline and feels that they have to go and have...
No, I'm
lots to drink.
I'm fizzing usually with a very nice ice cold beer, but No, I'm not a, you know, one really nice beer after a show, or sometimes a glass of wine, but then I'm straight to bed. Because I wake up wherever I am, whatever the time zone, 6:30 in the morning, hello. Yeah. It's, you know, I'm just so happy to be able to pursue my favourite hobby in life every 24 hours. My hobby being waking up in the morning.
Yeah. So easy to please. That was the band, that was a picture of the band that's on the tour, I think, isn't it?
Yeah, yeah. So this starts in April. How long is it going on for? Is he going to be like Leonard Cohen's final tour?
No, I mean, I've said to everybody, listen, I'm not going to be a party pooper. I'm going to really enjoy and totally get behind having a lot of fun doing the 50th anniversary tour. But I console myself with the knowledge it's only for 10 and a half months. And then I can get on with the rest of my life, I thought, because yesterday, I think it was my son, who's my agent, apart from North America where it's somebody else, but the rest of the world is my son. I mean, if you're going to pay your agent 10%, you might as well keep it in the family, right?
Yeah.
So he said, I'm starting getting these offers for next year, and, you know, how far do we want to go on doing the 50th anniversary? I said, well, you know, if it's some places that maybe we couldn't physically, geographically fit in this year, maybe we can creep into 2019, but I don't want to go back to America or the UK doing the 50th anniversary tour more of. It's not the 50th, this would be the 51st anniversary, which doesn't have that ring of
it's not
marketing sensibility about it.
Right. Well, we wish you the very best of luck with that.
Yeah, and true to your word, it's 1:01.
Absolutely.
And we're all
We want you to get back to the West Country, and, you know, you're looking at the inside of your lids by about 10:30. It's been a delight having you here this evening. Ladies and gentlemen, Ian Anderson.
Cheers.
This podcast was brought to you by The Word. Thanks very much, yeah.